This Week in Retronauts, whipping it in your pants.
This episode is brought to you by Audible, the audiobook service with more than 180,000 titles to choose from. Get a free audiobook and a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/game. And welcome to the latest episode of Retronauts. Shane, you look horrified.
Your little tagline at the beginning was kind of, I don't know, nasty and
what?
Low class. And
it's Castlevania on a portable system.
I guess
so.
In this year, the level of discourse has truly been lowered.
Wow! Did you just compare me to the?
I'm not saying
he
should not be named, but.
Good
yeah,
Lord.
Like the first where you go straight to a low sexual pun where we're talking about one of the most revered franchises in console history.
Okay. Also a dead franchise. So let's just get it out of the way, shall we? Hi, everyone. I'm Jeremy Parrish, and apparently I'm crass. And this episode of Retronauts is about portable Castlevania games, not the Game Boy ones. Was there one in Game Gear? There wasn't. No. Not the mobile ones, not the LED handheld ones, just the Game Boy.
Wait, we
can't
talk about
DS.
Game.com?
No.
I played Symphony of the Night for
Game.com. Was that released?
No,
ever?
I didn't think so. It was at the same E3 with Metal Gear Solid.
They were like, this should not exist. Let's not release this.
So who are these dudes who are also on the podcast?
I'm Bob Mackey. I'm always here. And who else is here?
This is Shane Bettenhausen, frequent guest.
Because who better to talk about Castlevania with us? Apparently, you weren't on the most recent Castlevania episode, which was Castlevania Rondo of Blood and Symphony of the Night.
No, and I actually saved that for like months to prepare myself. I wanted to save it for right before this one. So I just listened to it last week and I got really, really, you know, kind of excited yet angry a few times.
Angry?
You tend to get angry
about
Retronauts.
Well, I mean
– usually at me.
Potentially, you know, it's someone who hasn't played one of the most important games and just kind of pops up with like a random like, hey, you should download this ROM idea about it. Nothing personal about that.
Download them ROMs, boys.
I felt like that Jeremy did a great job. You talked a lot. You had a lot to say. But yeah, I felt there were elements of Symphony of the Night and Rondo of Blood that were not explored fully.
Hmm. Well, we only had an hour and a half.
This is a post-show critique.
This is true. And then I was hoping that when I got invited to do this one, you would not include one of the games that you are including today because I have actually written it out of the continuity.
Which is Circle of the Moon?
I know. I guess where we're starting. And I guess reading your notes, I know we're going to clash a little bit today. So I'm kind of excited. And these games, you and I were both at 1UP EGM back in the day when most of these came out.
Yeah. Actually, one of my – you know, I was always importing Castlevania games before they came out. And I have a fond memory of leaving Tokyo Game Show in, I guess, 2007. And we were at customs to, you know, do the immigration out of the country. And you passed over an advance review ROM of Portrait of Ruin. And I played that all the way back.
That's awesome. That's a great memory. From
Japan.
So, yeah, you and I were both, you know, huge fans of Symphony of the Night going into this generation of GBA and DS games. So I think you and I were both also close to the projects in that we interviewed the teams multiple times, mm-hmm. did stories. So
if you go back in Retronauts history, Shane was on the first couple of Castlevania episodes. There were at least three Castlevania episodes in the beginning of Retronauts.
Right. Yeah.
Like I realize we're retreading some familiar territory, but we haven't really talked about these games.
No, I mean we've also grown in 10 years, I think, as people and Castlevania fans.
To think about these as retro games now also affords us like a lot of distance, and the genre has changed fundamentally and like changed hands. Mm-hmm. Like the genre is not kind of owned by indies, and like it's interesting to see these games from that perspective. I was actually really happy to revisit these, and my opinions have changed a little bit on some of the aspects of it too.
Yeah, I didn't play all the way through any of these in preparation, but I did play a little bit of all of them.
Yeah, same here.
Some of them hold up really, really well. Others not so much, but we can talk about that.
But yeah, I think you guys did pretty much cover most everything important to think about Symphony of the Night, and you can't think about these games except, you know, in view of the template that struck, you know.
And that is a good place to start. We'll be right back. So yeah, you mentioned Castlevania Symphony of the Night, and I do think that is kind of the inflection point for these games because, you know, Castlevania up until Symphony of the Night, and even beyond actually, a few years past, like once you got away from the NES, there was sort of this confusion about what is Castlevania? Like Super Castlevania IV was its own thing. And then the next game that came along was Rondo of Blood, which was kind of like a throwback to Castlevania III, but also like loaded with fan service, but also kind of like not really an official Castlevania game because it was called Dracula X and it had the anime style and it was kind of experimental. And then you had Bloodlines, which was much more of a traditional Castlevania game. So there was like this kind of dancing around like, what are we doing?
Well, do you remember how you felt then? I do. I remember being really excited that it was suddenly branching into all these three unique paths that all interrelated kind of, but had a unique view. It's kind of like a little bit later, Mega Man would do the same thing, but not as well, maybe, or you know, maybe as well at times.
Yeah, I was mostly frustrated because I loved Castlevania IV and I wanted another game like that, and we never got another game like that. Mm. The closest that I guess we ever had was the X68000 Castlevania, which I didn't even know existed until like 1999.
So after playing Super Castlevania IV, the next one you probably played was Bloodlines, and then you played Rondo of Blood eventually, right?
I was familiar with Bloodlines, but I didn't have a Genesis, so, I kind of like was familiar with it in –
What about you, Bob?
What about me?
Did you play either of those at their initial release or no?
Bloodlines and I played Super. I never had a Genesis growing up.
Also, I was really excited for Castlevania Bloodlines having played Super Castlevania IV, and – at the time, it was like, whoa, this is such a throwback to Castlevania 1 mm-hmm. and 3, mm-hmm. you know, whereas Rondo of Blood had seen screenshots of it. That was like an interesting throwback to 3 as well in a different direction. So like I played them in that order, Super Castlevania 4, you know, Vampire Killer, Bloodlines, then Rondo. And like having played all those around the time they were released, it was a really exciting thing to experience.
I think my dark secret is I didn't actually like Castlevania until Symphony of the Night. I could appreciate it, but it was too hard. And, you know, interviewing Igarashi, as Jeremy and I did, and you did too, Shane, like he made Castlevania Symphony of the Night for players who thought the other games were too difficult.
Right. So, see, I still have the experience.
It works.
I still have the experience of learning how to beat the Grim Reaper on the playground, you know, when I was in grade school, like that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, you should use the holy water and have a triple multiplier.
Yeah. So Symphony of the Night, like that, you know, I think as Americans necessarily understand the lineage there, the fact that it was based on Rondo of Blood and was a sequel to that. I mean, even in the U.S. version, it said Bloodlines was the prologue.
Yeah, I was thinking of that.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's kind of weird.
Like,
but
you imported Knocked in the Moonlight. You know,
I did, yeah.
So when you first put it in and you realized this is the end of Rondo of Blood, you were not like awestruck in the,
no,
way, in the way that
those – No, I didn't
know
Rondo of Blood.
See, like that had really never happened before.
I had seen Dracula X, yeah. But I hadn't really played it because I was like, oh, that's not Castlevania IV sequel. I don't care about
that. Well, so I think for younger people, it's hard to think back. They weren't there to experience like the first time you ever played a game that did that. The first time you ever played a game that instantly thrust you back into the climax of a previous game and let you relive it, and then directly continue into the next game. So
yeah,
I
didn't get the actual connection, but I still thought it was cool. Right. I was like, wow, it's like the final battle with Dracula.
Yeah.
And that was the first game that I ever imported was Nocturne in the Moonlight.
Well, so I guess we should talk about Circle of the Moon now.
Right.
Because like
so
following that excitement.
Where I'm going from this is that Symphony of the Night was kind of this sort of experimental offshoot also. Like they let them do it on PlayStation. It was kind of cool. They did some interesting things with 3D technology. But that's not really where Konami wanted to take Castlevania. Where they really wanted to take it was, you know, to make it a 3D action game like Mario 64 and, I don't know, Crash Bandicoot or something. So you had Castlevania for Nintendo 64. That was like the next game. But that was a mess. Like they didn't even finish the game before they launched it. They ended up coming out with a
fixed
sequel, which was actually just the finished game.
And I think you should actually do at one point like a micro about some of these other like bastard Castlevanias.
Oh, yeah. No, we'll do a full episode on it.
But at the time, again, like we were suspect of Castlevania 64. It looked blurrier and muddier and less fun than most N64 titles. And when it came out and was kind of bad, nobody was shocked.
I was excited for it. I was like, wow, it's like sort of a modern era Castlevania. It's the early 20th century.
It's an interesting disaster, actually.
Then I played it and it wasn't fun.
It does have skeletons on motorcycles, which is a nice choice.
Cool. It's also, after that, it's all downhill.
Right. It's also crazy long, actually, like especially the Curse of Darkness.
Yeah.
Like, it's insane.
And it does some interesting things. Like you have, you know, the chainsaw chase with Frankenstein's monster or whatever through a maze. Like there's weird stuff happening and it's creative, but it doesn't quite work.
Right.
And
well, and that's good because to think what if they would have tried to recreate that on GBA instead of SODN. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think at that point they started to realize Castlevania in, you know, 3D space, that's going to be tough. Around the time, that Circle of the Moon was in development, you also had Dracula – oh, crap. Or Castlevania what was it called? Like –
Which one?
What Legacy? No, not Legacy.
What platform?
The Dreamcast one that never happened.
Oh, Resurrection?
Yes, Castlevania Resurrection.
Yeah. Yeah, Made in the West. It had like – there was like a – you can find footage out there of like a Medusa. It looks kind of tragic. I don't know. I was glad it was canceled.
Yeah. I mean that was canceled probably because the Dreamcast failed, but also I think because it did not look very good and it was a mess.
I guess we're talking about cancel. There's also a canceled 32X Castlevania as well.
Yeah, but that's not relevant to this.
A blip on the radar.
Like where I'm going with this is that – 3D Castlevania was not really a starter.
The central, you know, having to use a whip to attack in 3D is difficult to do correctly.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
It can be done, but they were having trouble with it. It's something that wasn't coming together for them. So all of this leads to Game Boy Advance.
But wait, I have one question for you, Jeremy. What was Igarashi doing between Symphony of the Night and Circle of the Moon? And I know he didn't do Circle of the Moon, but I was just wondering, like, why was he not doing more Castlevania? Was he on the N64 games? Was he?
No, he had worked on Tokimeki Memorial.
Right,
that was still pretty vibrant at that time. It was getting ported, so he worked on like a PS1 and Saturn ports of Tokimeki Memorial.
I'm just curious as to where he went between Symphony of the Night.
He helped out on like the Proteus stuff sometimes.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, he wasn't like executive level or producer level at that point.
Yeah.
He was like the guy who came in and helped out with Castlevania Symphony of the Night when the director left.
That's right.
He like hadn't been kind of appointed as the guy to spearhead everything. That didn't happen until 2002.
Right. And the other Castlevanias like Circle of the Moon and N64 were happening out of other parts of Tokyo, other parts of Konami.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. I mean, in Kobe and stuff, not in Tokyo. Yeah.
Yes. You guys are messing up my narrative here, but that's okay because what we are ultimately leading to is Castlevania Circle of the Moon.
Were you at Space World 2000?
I was not. I was not in the games press until 2003.
So I was there. I was my first trip to Japan. I was super excited. I worked for Gamers.com where they revealed the GameCube and the Game Boy Advance.
That was a legendary show.
It was.
I always hear about it.
Well, and like it's
history.
Funny, like in lieu of the recent Switch reveal, like I was like, where are the models carrying the Switches on stage like they had for that one? And so I remember I was excited to play Circle of the Moon. It was one of the games that was playable directly after the presentation. And immediately I'm like, I can't see this. It's so dark. That was my initial thought.
Yes.
That was everyone's thought.
Because remember, this system was not backlit.
But let's talk about why this game happened and how it came to be. Basically, I feel like after all the troubles they had with 3D Castlevania games, they stopped and said, like, how can we make Castlevania work? And they looked to see what had worked and they looked and said, you know, like the 2D games, those are still okay. Like those have been pretty successful for us. Castlevania Legacy of Darkness, maybe – or not Legacy of Darkness, Legends. Castlevania Legends for Game Boy, like the very late Game Boy release.
The one with Sonia Belmont.
Yes, that they tried to tie Alucard to.
Which was only I think a year or two before this actually.
It was 1998. It was a really late game.
Yeah, yeah. Quite late.
And it was 3 years before this.
Better than Castlevania Adventure, but not as good as Castlevania Adventure 2.
It was a weird step backward. But you know, aside from that one, they just looked and said like maybe doing the 2D games makes sense. And Game Boy Advance was the logical place to put those games because, you know, N64, GameCube, PS1, PS2, Dreamcast, Xbox, all of those were kind of pushing to next-gen graphics, which meant higher budgets, which meant, you know, more expensive games, larger development teams. But Game Boy Advance, that would allow them to create comfortable Castlevania experiences that, you know, could use a winning formula and not have to have a gigantic team, and they could also reuse assets.
Right.
So, it was just a very pragmatic choice.
It's pretty clear if you play the launch lineup that there wasn't a whole lot of time for any of it.
Yeah.
You know, they probably only had like 9 months or something, right? So, you know, it's kind of clear at launch that a lot of the games don't tap into what's good about the GBA hardware. And I think in previous episodes you've talked about how early on they really had to balance graphics versus sound, and this is a game early on that – balanced on sound very heavily. And I think that is why many people have fond memories of this. It's a fantastic sampled soundtrack attached to a terrible Castlevania.
Well, the soundtrack is largely borrowed from the greatest hits of past games.
It is, right?
That's why I said sampled.
Sampled. Okay. Yeah. I thought you meant the actual sampling
The sound actually is like – it's like streaming audio.
Right.
It's not generated by the Game Boy Advance.
Right.
Harmony of Dissonance would have generated PCM sound and people hate that.
That's strange because I feel like we've gone on to appreciate that kind of that kind of sound later.
Well, Harmony of Dissonance also has other troubles. But we'll get there.
But like, I remember being at EGM and like people were just immediately like, "Oh man, I love this music. It's some of the best tracks I remember from the last few games. I love this game immediately."
The menu select screen or the character select screen has like Requiem from Rondo of Blood, which I had never even heard because I hadn't played Rondo of Blood yet because it hadn't come to the US.
Right. And this is coming expensive. This is coming out of your little GBA at launch. It's
right.
Wow.
So there's like a woman singing to me from my GBA. And that was kind of a gimmick for a lot of early launch games, you know. Super Mario Advance.
Toad speaking to you.
Everyone made noises.
He picks a vegetable. He's a
But, you know, I've always talked about like the weird sound design of Wario Land 4 where you had like all kinds of like weird echoey distorted sounds. Right. But then you also had like that song that plays in the seaside stages, and then like you get stung by bees and it distorts and stretches. Like people were really interested. I think developers were really interested in what you could do with the Game Boy Advance's, you know, storage space and hardware and what you could do with sound. And you really kind of lost that later on. You know, the Wario team kept going with WarioWare and then Rhythm Heaven, but everyone else was kind of just like, let's dial it back a little bit.
Do you think that's because Nintendo really just knew the hardware better and didn't have to work as hard, maybe?
No, I think people, you know, there's when you're dealing with a limited platform like GBA and limited file size and, you know, storage space, everything you do is a trade-off. Mm. So I think people decided that they wanted to trade in other directions like scope or maybe have an FMV in there at the beginning or have nicer graphics or more characters.
Wario Land 4 looks really good and also sounds really good. I don't know how they did that.
It's like, but it wasn't launch.
That's true. It was August, I think.
It was a few months. I guess if it's first party too.
Yeah.
I mean I was playing the Japanese version in the summer of 2001.
That's true.
So it was like 2 or 3 months after the system's launch. So it was not a late
game. Was Circle Moon made by Kobe or was it made by – who made this one?
Well, let's look at the notes. So Castlevania Circle of the Moon was a Game Boy Advance launch title produced by KCE, Konami Computer Entertainment, Kobe. The team responsible for Castlevania 64.
And also the Goemon games, correct? Or is that Osaka? No, that was Osaka. Yeah. Okay.
But Castlevania 64 is the one we care about. Yeah. So this is the people who made the messy, incomplete 3D Castlevania game, making a messy, kind of unbalanced 2D Castlevania game. So maybe they just had some troubles. But there were some interesting ideas here. It just didn't quite work out.
Well, and like the darkness, I probably don't blame them as much because I bet when they were developing it, they were looking at it on some sort of monitor that was lit up and they probably didn't have the final hardware and didn't know how dark it was
going to
look.
Okay, we need to do a little more explaining here because you're talking from an insider perspective like everyone knows what you're talking about.
So when you look at this game on your GBA screen, you see kind of an outline of the levels. I mean, it is dark. It's hard to look at. It's hard to figure out what you're looking at.
The original Game Boy Advance did not have a backlit screen.
I mean,
it didn't have a sidelit screen. It had a barely reflective.
The viewing angle was LED, slight.
LCD. Yeah. I mean, this is retreading every webcomic from that year, but I had to play this game outside because that was the only way I could see it. It was sitting in my backyard on the porch.
Maybe Boktai, that was the solution.
Yeah,
you have to play this.
It was.
Outside.
Stop complaining about the screen.
I think Boktai was very much inspired by like the fact that, man, you can't see this game. My memories of the first year of Game Boy Advance are me sitting in a chair right next to a lamp and holding my game system at an angle just right so I could see what was happening on
the
screen.
It was common to buy an accessory to project a light onto the front of your screen.
Yeah.
And Circle of the Moon was a really exceptional case, I think. Like it was extremely bad because, you know, it's Castlevania. It's got to be spooky and dark. But you add that spooky darkness to a screen that is naturally just dark, dim.
Right.
It was a difficult experience.
And the art style itself, like it's not exactly like any of the previous ones. It's kind of a mishmash, a little more serious and, you know, adult looking, I guess.
Yeah. Everything is just a little off. I mean, I played it first. I downloaded them all for the Wii U just to play them all again. I played it first. I'm like, oh, this is fine. And then I played Harmony of Dissonance immediately afterwards. I'm like, oh, no, there are like so many tiny things they don't get right, like the jumping, the moving, the menus are bland.
The controls in Circle of the Moon are really the biggest
problem. So let's pull back a second and actually just talk about what this game is. So Castlevania Circle of the Moon is the first portable Castlevania game to break from the just like traditional one level at a time structure and go into the Symphony of the Night style, nonlinear, exploratory, map out the castle style with equipment and a skill system and exploration and consumable items and so forth.
The skill system is DSS. Yeah, we'll get to that.
We'll talk about that. But basically, it is an attempt to kind of do the Symphony of the Night thing. And it's very inelegant. But so to put it in the context of the time, you have to understand this was a Game Boy Advance launch title. And therefore, it was by far the best looking and sounding and one of the hugest, like in terms of scope and substance, portable games ever seen.
And not a rehash. So a lot of the launch lineup was rehashed content.
Yeah, yeah. It was not a Mario Advance. It was a brand new game. And that, I think, wallpapered over a lot of the problems, at least at the very beginning. It's a really hard game to go back to, but at the time, it was kind of mind-blowing.
Well, and it was our first follow-up from Symphony of the Night. And even at the time, we knew it wasn't the exact same development team, but they were clearly inspired by. So it was – yeah.
I like that the director's name is Koji.
Right.
not Koji Igarashi. It's Koji.
But for someone like me who always had a chip on my shoulder against Game Boy, it was a glimpse to like, oh man, I can actually embrace this console. It's not going to be sloppy, wannabe games.
I've always felt that of all the Castlevania games, like the portables, Circle of the Moon seems the most like a Genesis game, and that's not a knock on it. It's just like something about the visual style and some of the play mechanics.
Well, and I think
like it just feels it has that kind of like, this isn't the comfortable Nintendo way of doing things. We're doing things our own way, and it's going to be a little different. Well, but that's like learn to love it.
It's funny you say that because I've always felt that too a little bit, and it almost feels like it's like Sega trying to make a Castlevania game or something weird.
Part of it is the color depth, the way the graphics are designed,
and like the way the characters look and the controls. Because like having come out of Super Castlevania 4 and Symphony of the Night with really great deep controls that felt super tight for that franchise, which began with clunky controls, this felt like a step backwards.
And that's not a knock on Sega or Genesis. It's just like, the two platforms, Nintendo and Sega, always had a different way of doing things. And this feels like, Castlevania was always really at heart a Nintendo franchise. And this is like the weird kind of offbeat version. Like,
if you were to take
Bloodlines and make it nonlinear, you'd probably come up with something that feels a bit like Circle of the Moon.
Right.
Now, the fact that the systems don't work, that's another story entirely. That doesn't have anything to do with the Sega feel of it. It's just like the overall impression it gives, the aesthetics of it.
And I think the story also feels more like a Bloodline story. It feels like it connects more to the original Castlevania – I mean the original Dracula novel.
Well, yeah, it does. I mean it's – okay. So that's another important point is that, Symphony of the Night – took the action away from the Belmonts and put Alucard, the son of Dracula,
as the lead Michonne character. Helped Castlevania's narrative immensely.
Yeah, this guy is not pretty enough for me.
Yeah.
Who is his name, Chris?
Nathan Graves.
Nathan. Who remembers – like he's totally forgotten.
Yeah, he's – well, I mean he's been retconned out of the series franchise.
Good.
And the series has been retconned now.
No!
That's another story.
God, quit saying that.
I know. It tears your heart.
Have you played the new Pachinko game?
I was going to say, Dracula's
the erotic
castle.
Violence? I love it.
The erotic violence.
Back to the intro there.
Yeah. So this does – it feels like it's somehow tied to the novel Dracula even though it's not actually. The Nathan Graves is like the protege of a guy named Morris Baldwin, which isn't quite the name of a character from the Dracula novel, but it's sort of close.
He's the worst Baldwin – no, wait. Billy's worse.
It evokes a character.
Adam's pretty bad.
The character's name from that.
His Trump is great. Alec. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. So, what was I saying? Right. So,
does it actually fit into the previous narrative of Castlevania? Not really.
No.
No.
It doesn't fit anywhere in the Castlevania narrative. Like, it takes place in, I want to say, like the late 19th century.
Sounds about right.
So,
but it doesn't do anything interesting with that. There's no,
Right. Yeah. And it's once again some person summoning Dracula from the grave.
Well, and the entire game takes place inside the castle, if I recall correctly, right? There's nothing, there's nothing prior. Because with the succeeding games, we'll see they start branching away from, you're just in Dracula's castle.
The game begins with Dracula's resurrection.
Yeah. Yeah.
And instead of like killing everyone, he just sends them to the basement.
Yeah. Right. They're grounded.
Like, go play in the basement, boys. So there's Nathan Graves, and then there's his friend Hugh Baldwin, who is Morris Baldwin's son. Apparently, Morris Baldwin had beaten Dracula in the past, and he gets captured at the beginning. And so Hugh and Nathan get dropped into the basement, and they have to go run off and do stuff. Anyway, And he becomes a bad guy.
Yeah, you meet him occasionally throughout. He's kind of your rival. Mm.
That's a common theme in these games.
It is.
Like the second character always gets corrupted or whatever.
Yeah, there's a – I guess there's only so much you can do with the narrative of a guy who's running around Dracula's castle.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that's kind of the introduction. And then from there, it becomes this big exploratory adventure and you kind of find your way around and you have to, you know, acquire different power-ups like early on you acquire the ability to do a double tap dash, which helps you do longer jumps. That's where the game starts to fall apart actually because the control mechanics in this game are really weird. Like Nathan walks at a really slow pace and when you jump, he jumps really high but it's very, very short like in terms of how far he jumps. So you basically spend the entire game double tapping and running because that way you can actually do a normal jump. So like I don't know why they incorporated that element to it because there's no reason not to just double tap and run everywhere. And you get this right away like within the first 5 minutes of the game. So for the rest of the game, anytime you want to go anywhere, you're double tapping. And it's just like this is a basic design element of the game where it seems like they didn't really think it through. Hmm. And to me, that's kind of emblematic of the entire Circle of the Moon experience. And as Shane said, they didn't have much time to put this together. So, you know, with another 4 to 6 months of development time, maybe this game could have been just perfect. But as it is, it just has this whole cascade of problems that starts with the double jump or the double tap and just gets worse from there.
Well, and it's interesting. You know, we're talking about 6 games here. And this is the one where I literally remembered absolutely no stages, no bosses. You know, when looking at screenshots, I'm like, yeah, I kind of remember this, but there's very few new ideas here.
Yeah, it's a really weirdly balanced game too. Like some enemies, you know, you just hit them and they die, but other enemies, you just have to keep pounding on them and pounding on them. There's an experience system, so you kind of level up as you go, but it seems like it kind of reminds me of the leveling mechanics from Mother for Famicom.
Which is punishing.
Yeah. Like it is very much that way. And I've never beaten this game legitimately because the final battle with Dracula
is
so grueling.
It's really bad.
He flies all over the screen and he has like this chariot thing he's running around on and it takes forever to destroy him. And he hits really hard and yeah, it's just like it's not fun. And so I ended up cheating and game sharking myself infinite potions. And that's the only way I've been able to see the ending. And I suppose in theory you could legitimately gain infinite potions. But here's the thing. There are consumable items in this game, but there's no shop. To get any consumable item, you have to get it as a random drop. And things like potions are not nearly as common as you would expect. So in order to actually have a stock of healing items – you just have to keep grinding and hitting enemies. And also the basic DSS system, the cards that you collect, also many of those are random
drops. They're drops, right? Yeah.
There are a few that are placed.
Most of them are drops.
They're all drops, but there are a few enemies that you kill. And when you kill that enemy, you will get like a plot mandatory or mechanically mandatory DSS card. But otherwise – like you have 20 cards total you can acquire and you're probably not going to find more than like 6 or 7
again,
in the course of the game.
The traversal is so not fun that farming stuff isn't fun either in this game and it's hard to see. So like, yeah, it all kind of added up to like I want to love this. I didn't love it. And I think at the time a lot of people made themselves like it and you know, now all these years later many people are like, yeah, not so good.
And I don't think the cards had anything to do with the enemies that carried them either because in,
some did.
In future games you'd be like, I want that thing's soul. I'll fight that thing until I get it. Right,
It was like most of the cards were planets. Like one row of the cards was like Mercury, Venus, Mars, etc. And then the other row was like legendary beasts like Salamander and Dragon and stuff like that. Mm. And yeah, it didn't really have any connection to the enemies. There was no indication within the game of which enemy was going to give you cards.
It's not like, okay, what do I kill now?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's like GameFAQs Delight right there. It's really not a game you can complete and master on your own steam without like knowing, okay, I have to hit this enemy and keep killing it and eventually it will give me this drop. But some of the drops are almost essential to being able to complete the game. So do you want to explain how the DSS works?
You know, I don't completely remember it. But you don't level things up, right? You just get them and you connect them?
I just played it. I mean there are 2 rows of cards, 10 each, and you can connect one from the top row and one from the bottom row for a different effect. So there's like 100 effects.
Yeah.
And some of them are like great, like, you know, elemental effects. Some of them are kind of, you know, useless, but
– And you use hearts, right?
There's an MP meter that recharges.
Okay, like, okay. And some of them, yeah. And some of them are just passive boosts, aren't they?
I think so. Yeah, but the hearts
but
are
some
just
of them
for
you have to like
weapons.
Hit the R trigger.
Yeah,
but
and
can,
that'll
can
activate
you combine
your
the special weapon with the DSS. Is that
no?
That's
you're
a
thinking of Harmony of Dissonance.
I'm thinking of Harmony of Dissonance. Okay. Yeah,
where they kind of reworked the DSS.
Right. Yeah, the hearts are just for special weapons in this game.
Okay, I do remember that there are some combinations.
There's
that
a magic point.
There are some combinations that are like really essential and amazing, and like there's a few that you'll want to use through most of the game, right?
Yeah, yeah. But you don't know what those are. There's no indication of what they are. They are. There's no way to know which enemy you have to kill to get those card combinations. It's very, very unintuitive.
In Dark Souls, you'd like that.
Dark Souls has better design than this. Like Dark Souls,
it does. Like the things enemies drop make sense.
There's logic to Dark Souls.
It's
that's
punishingly
why it works.
Hard and dark. Man, this game was ahead of its time.
Well, no, I'm the one not making a Dark Souls reference. That's
this, this game is arbitrary and random, and it's not fun.
Not fun.
Okay, I'm sure people are going to be angry about this. I know people love Circle of the Moon.
No, but you're wrong. Reassess your life.
I just think you need to go back and play it and really like see Circle of the Moon through eyes unclouded by nostalgia.
It's too late. We just got 3 1-star reviews
on
iTunes.
In EGM, it got 9s and 10s, and I know these people. And at the time, I was constantly fighting with them about it. I think it should get like a 7 at best.
I mean, I was in love with this game for the first 2 hours, and then after a couple of hours, I was like, I don't think I want to play this anymore. So then I went back years later when, you know, the backlit SP came out and I had a Game Shark and I was like, okay, I'm just going to cheat my way to the end. And it wasn't really fun doing that either. Mm. Like sucking the challenge out didn't make the game more interesting, but if I hadn't, the game would not have been interesting. It's a very rushed game.
Quick question. Is this game valuable in any form?
No, it's not a hard game to come by.
Well, and also I remember at the time, you know, it was a huge hit here. It was one of like the must-have games at launch. But in Japan, no one was buying it. And that was me beginning to realize, wait a minute, people in the West love Castlevania, but people in Japan don't really give too much about this franchise. Yeah.
So that was Castlevania Circle of the Moon, the series' first nonlinear outing on a portable system. It was not a huge success in terms of design, but evidently it did really well. So they were like, let's make another one of those. But this time they stepped back and they took the game away from Kobe, the Kobe studio, and gave it to Tokyo. And they put Koji Igarashi in charge of it.
Yay.
And I'm not sure how this came to be. I don't know if he went to them and was like,
he wanted to do it.
You have to let me design a Castlevania game because that thing, no, that's not good. I can do better.
Because I covered this one and I remember he was excited to do it. He was excited about the hardware. But then the challenges of the hardware hit him over the head because he wanted to do something very different than what had been done in Circle of the Moon. And he brought his like dream team back together with the illustrator Ayami Kojima and his composer Michiru Yamane. And the idea was to really expand on what he had done in Symphony of the Night, but for this new console.
It didn't quite work out. This game is also plagued with problems. It plays better than Circle of the Moon by far. It's not nearly as arbitrary and random, but it's still kind of a mess in a few ways. But I do appreciate the fact that there are some things about Harmony of Dissonance that are very much a direct response to the problems of Circle of the Moon.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, you have the graphics. They're, you know, when you look at them now on a backlit system, they're really garish, but they were very bright and, you know, juiced the main character, juiced Belmont.
Yeah, well, there's lots
he
of,
has a he has a like a glowing outline like Alucard.
But there's lots of like red and blue and colors you're not used to seeing.
Yeah, very
–
well, I mean, part of that it comes down to the dual world system. Mm-hmm. Like all the garish colors are in sort of the alternate world,
right?
But you don't realize that at first. The graphics are much easier, much clearer on a normal Game Boy Advance screen. Garish on a backlit screen, but they worked at the time, so that was important.
Also on first look, they do look more like the graphics you remember. The style, like it's a huge turn from what you saw in Circle of the Moon.
He even leaves like a trail of like doppelgangers behind him as he walks.
Yeah.
But I mean, the overall art style is much more traditional Symphony of the Night style.
Yeah.
Also, the way Juiced moves, they got rid of the double tap, and they give you the ability to back dash and dash forward, with the R and left triggers.
It feels really good.
Yeah, like you zip through the castle. And one of the interesting things about this is that the dashing does not affect the arc of your jump. Like you don't get extra distance or height on your jump by dashing. So it's not like mandatory in that sense. It's just you can, you know, dash around really quickly just to get through the castle, which turns out to be really important. But it's not busted in the same way that Circle of the Moon had like that fundamental design interface issue, which is great. And then the skill system that you use is like the DSS system, but more integrated into Castlevania mechanics and a lot less random. Because the way it works is, I think the idea is that Joost is like he's Simon Belmont's grandson, so he taps into Saifa Belnati's, like that part of his lineage,
right.
to you know, kind of be a mage style vampire.
He's
character.
Like a combination of Alucard and Belmont almost.
Right.
Yeah. I also wanted to interject real quick. This is also where the franchises start having different subtitles in America and Japan. And the Japanese ones are always really great. Like this one translates to
concerto. White Knight Concerto.
Yeah, White Knight Concerto.
Wasn't this actually called Castlevania in Japan for the first time?
Yeah, they aligned them together.
For like two or three games, they called it Castlevania. And they were like, well, no, back to Akumajo Dracula.
There's another system which is kind of meaningless but fun where you decorate a room. You collect random like decorations throughout this game. And also you mentioned the two – like the alternate castle, this two-world setup.
We'll get to
but
that.
I'll say they do introduce that very quickly in the game, which is weird too. Coming out of Symphony of the Night, you expect them, oh, is there going to be an upside-down castle? What will happen? And this game kind of throws it at you.
We'll talk about that. Yeah. But yeah, like the skill system is what I want to talk about because it really does feel more like an attempt to make DSS work as a Castlevania system.
But
because
there are fewer things to collect though, right, overall? Then Circle of the Moon. I remember thinking
you have a lot of magic spells, but the way it works is you get a magic spell and then you can pair that with the sub-weapon.
Right.
So there are fewer sub-weapons.
The traditional sub-weapons.
Right. Mm-hmm. So you have like the axe, the boomerang, the dagger, the holy water, etc. Yeah. So you get these things and you can either cast the spell on its own or you can use a sub-weapon on its own, but you can also combine them. So if you have like the ice spell and the boomerang, the cross – then it creates like this series of sharp ice daggers that flies around you kind of like a shield and then darts forward and sort of like machine guns enemies. Mm. There's all kinds of stuff. You can do like frozen rain and holy fire, water. I don't even know. Like there's a ton of different options and most of them are actually really valuable. So it becomes very customizable, situational. Unlike the DSS, it's always pretty intuitive what your abilities are going to do. And they feel like a natural extension of, you know, the existing Castlevania sub-weapon mechanics. So it works really well. That's one of my favorite things about this game, actually.
They do tend to make the game a little easy once you master them. I remember some of the bosses were like, you know, decimated. If you can figure out what the right thing to do against them, a little bit Mega Man style.
Bosses in this are a point of contention because pretty much all of them are just larger versions of normal enemies.
Right.
So there was this sense of like, I don't have any good ideas.
I guess we should also mention this is also where you start to see some sprites you might have remembered from the
all your favorites are back.
Well, and at this point, it was like, oh, this is an interesting way to do variation on a theme.
I mean, Symphony of the Night did that,
right? And well, and like
you had like the Spear Knights, and you had Slagra and Gaibon,
right? And at the time, it's like, oh, as a Castlevania fan, I love that these recurring motifs are coming back. I like that it's giving me the service I want. And at the time, it didn't quite feel like a rehash or that they're like cutting corners. Yet.
Yeah, actually, Circle of the Moon, I don't think they reuse sprites because they all look a little weird.
Right.
The Axe Knights look weird. Right. They don't throw the axes the right way.
It was like, oh, remember these sprites from Symphony of the Night and Rondo of Blood? They're great. I'm glad they're back at this point.
So this is you know, kind of a traditional Castlevania in that, you know, you do have the magic system, but your basic weapon is a whip. However, in this one, you're allowed to customize your whip with different attributes. Some of them are just like you can do the whip spin from Circle of the Moon or you can do like the limp the whip thing from Castlevania 4. But there are other attributes like I think like a power stone that can break walls and things like that. So they definitely played around with that and they really did try to say like let's make a you know symphony style adventure but let's put a Belmont in it and let's see how that works. but it has a big failing, and we kind of touched on that, which is the two castle system.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's as big of a failing as you. It is confusing.
I'm with Sam. I'm kind of – I mean, Sam, it's not Sam. Ideal, but I can deal with it, you know.
Well, the problem I have with it is initially so I get what they were trying to do. Like they said, you know, we had the big reveal of the second castle at the end of Circle of 70 of the Night, and that was really
cool. Which some gamers never even knew.
Right. Yeah. So how can we do that again but make it more of an integrated element of the game? So what they did was they basically gave you two castles to explore.
Like a front and back.
Right. Kind of. And they're like one is a parallel dimension basically. And they're interwoven, which you don't realize at first. But basically when you go through certain doors, you're passing through a portal between dimensions. So you like are running around and fighting through the castle and all of a sudden you're in this like weird space where, you know, it's like, you know, the normal levels, but in the background there's like clouds and rivers of lava and stuff. And you're like, whoa, that's weird. And the colors are ugly. And it turns out that you're actually like crossing between dimensions. And once you get to a certain point in the game, it becomes clear that there are the two parallel castles. And so then the challenge becomes like how do you navigate to the place you want to be in the correct dimension? And there are some interesting puzzles built around that. There's like one room where you have to like throw switches and stuff and there's like balls that roll. But for the most part, it just doesn't quite work because everything is sort of spread out. It's really difficult to get from one place to another quickly, even with the warp rooms. Because you do have that like that potential to be shunted between dimensions and end up in a completely wrong space.
And the layouts don't match as much as you think they're going to.
Yeah.
And it is confusing. But it was different. But it made it really difficult to get the full exploration of the castle, I remember.
Yeah. And it just – to me, it just sucks the fun out because navigating the castle isn't intuitive or fun. Like it doesn't make – well, it doesn't make – the physical sense.
I'll say the moment-to-moment level design here is not nearly as good as it was in Symphony of the Night.
Really
and you can tell.
Yeah.
It's a little underbaked.
Yeah. I played a bunch of these in a row recently, so I can't remember. How is this represented on the map? Is it confusing to read? Because I can't really remember.
There are two maps.
Two maps,
yeah.
Okay.
And that's confusing when you first see it. You're like, where am I? Oh, and like, yeah, they're different colors.
Yeah. It's like they played the Goonies 2 and were like, oh, yeah, okay. But they did it wrong.
But I will say I was kind of a defender of this game. I think I gave it a 9 or something. It's probably more of an 8, but it was definitely the direction I wanted the franchise to be going as opposed to Circle of the Moon.
It was a big improvement over Circle of the Moon, which I recognized at the time. I loved it at the time, but you know, this is one of those things where like each game that comes out is better than the last.
Right.
So then you kind of have to recalibrate. You're like, oh, Circle of the Moon wasn't actually that good. Oh, Harmony of Dissonance? I guess it could have been better. Aria of Sorrow? Yeah, I guess maybe we'll ratchet that back.
I'm surprised you didn't actually mention what is generally considered the huge problem with this game, which is the music.
I didn't have a problem with it.
Well, I want to say I've talked about reviews in the past how it's like a snapshot in time and they don't always age well. And I feel like this is another case of that because it was a different choice made. It sounds a lot like an NES game and I was reading old reviews like this sounds like an NES game. That's bad. But now we think like, oh no, those chiptunes are cool. I listen to them, you know, on albums and things like that. I think we've changed our minds.
The melodies are good.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
But at the time, it wasn't what people wanted.
Exactly,
I mean,
yeah.
The melodies can be good, but there's a lot of, I think, deliberate – dissonance in the soundtrack, and I think that's where they came up with the name for the U.S. subtitle, is that the music does have this kind of off-putting, like atonality to it. There are some real clashes in terms of music, and I think you hear more of those in sort of the alternate dimension, and that kind of helps set up the alien space. Like, you know, the opening track, Castlevania games always have just like this great rousing, let's go on an adventure style tune for the opening area. And this one's no different. But then you start getting into the other areas and you get like these kind of, you know, it's all like NES style, PCM, more like Game Boy style actually. I think it was basically Game Boy
hardware.
Well,
and the arrangements are just kind of sparse. There aren't a lot of instruments in them at a time.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
Yeah. So it's definitely in terms of like listenability, it's a step back from Circle of the Moon, which again was basically like taking Genesis music and PC Engine music and streaming it. Like,
yeah, and people compared those two things as if that had been composed using that hardware. So it was an unfair comparison.
Right. But I mean this game is, you know, twice as big and has much nicer visuals and, you know, so that was the trade-off they made. They were like, let's scale back on the music and just do hardware-based music as opposed to streaming music, but make the game better and bigger. And they did, and I think they made the right choice.
Yeah.
But yeah, that soundtrack was definitely a sticking spot for a lot of people. I bought the soundtrack on CD.
I did too. I think there's two.
Step off, there's two
like arranged tracks on there too that are really good as well. Yeah. Another thing, I think this game had some good, cool unlockables. There was a boss rush mode at the end that was fun.
Yeah. And you can actually play as 8-Bit Simon.
Right. He was super slow.
He's really strong, but he's really, really strong.
Really bad jumps too?
He plays like 8-Bit Simon Belmont. Yeah. But he kicks ass because he's so powerful. Anyway, so yeah, that game had its detractors, had its fans, but I don't think anyone can hate the next and final game in the Castlevania series for Game Boy Advance, which was Aria of Sorrow,
That's my favorite.
Some people put this right up there with Symphony of the Night. Some people say Castlevania never got better than this. People have different opinions, but it's a masterpiece under any circumstance. I know some people were really burnt out on Castlevania at this point, like, oh, it's another 2D nonlinear Castlevania game, and didn't give this a chance. But man, Aria of Sorrow is so good.
Actually, I kind of skipped the DS ones after this because I was burnt out. Now I'm like, how did I ever take these games for granted? I didn't know they would just stop.
We were spoiled back then. We didn't know. We didn't understand. Aria of Sorrow.
I love it. As you drink water. I actually do think in many, many ways it's the best one. And at the time, Iga was super excited because it was
definitely the most ambitious and daring one.
And he knew he was going to do this. When they made a Harmony, they had the plans to make this one too. And you can tell the logos are almost like inverses of each other. And this actually moved the narrative forward and got way deeper into the narrative that you wanted with Alucard. And he also realized like more connection to the previous games. Fans love this fan service. And like I remember the interviews for this one, just like he loved the franchise. He's a fan. And he decided to go as deep as he could, just trying to like really give people something that was better than Symphony of the Night. And I think he succeeded.
I think it's a better game. I do love Symphony of the Night. It has some messiness to it that is charming. Mm-hmm. But this game feels like the work of someone who has learned a lot since then.
Yeah, it's almost difficult to believe that Harmony of Dissonance and Aria of Sorrow came from the same team a year apart.
Yeah.
Because this game is so much deeper, so much more polished, so much more substantial than Harmony of Dissonance. Like everything about Aria of Sorrow just comes together perfectly. So let's start with – first of all, the setting. This was, like you said, it attempts to move the story forward. There is a tendency in like franchise fiction for people to be really reluctant to go past a certain point, like Star Wars. You know, it was a long time before we got The Force Awakens. And even now, we're doing all these prequels with Han Solo and Rogue One. Star Trek, you know, we're getting Star Trek Discovery, which is a prequel to the original series. No one's going past Voyager and Deep Space Nine.
I would also say that Castlevania is one of the guiltiest franchises in like, you know, self-cannibalizing itself. How many times have we had stage one of Castlevania? Like literally 20.
But this game is set in the middle of the 21st century. It was like set 30, 40 years in the future.
To be fair, it does nothing with that, but I'm okay with it.
You can get bazookas and handguns.
When Soma is wielding a laser gun, it's amazing.
They could put a laser gun in Symphony of the Night. I wouldn't even blink twice though, you know?
But there's a big narrative twist in that Dracula is dead. Like he was destroyed once and for all. The castle was sealed into an eclipse
in the
year 1999.
Right, in events that we've still never really seen happen in a game. It's interesting that Iga decided to like make this like MacGuffin of like this. Here's this the final battle for Dracula versus Belmont not shown.
Right. Yeah. And that's been the biggest fan request and demand for years. It's like we want the Battle of 1999.
Is this the game with Genya Arikado?
It is.
Okay, they should have just renamed him Dr. Acula. Who do you think Dracula is in this game?
Our protagonist is a spunky young teen named Soma Cruz.
He's not really that spunky. He's more surly.
He's
a squall. He's a definite squall.
That's true. But I like him. Like he was divisive when he was revealed. I remember like some people were like, oh, they're totally turning this into more anime.
Another white haired kid.
Yeah.
With a fur coat,
blue jeans.
Yep.
Yeah, he kind of has a pimp jacket on.
It's kind of weird.
And again, we said the same team. And again, the dream team, you know, Ayami Kojima, Michiro Yamane, and Iga and his whole development staff. And the visuals, there's a continuity from Harmony, but you can tell that there's more new art. And again, it looks different. The color choices are different.
It has probably the largest cast of any Castlevania game at this point, aside from the 3D ones, because you have, you know, Soma and his girlfriend Mina. And then there's Yoko Belnades, there's
Hammer,
Al Lookard or whatever.
Adicado. And then there's Adicado, Hammer, yeah. Right?
That's Hammer. There's Graham, the mysterious missionary.
Right.
There's the mysterious Jay.
Yes, the mysterious Jay. Yeah, so like there's lots of characters with beautiful, you know, Kojima portraits popping up. There's a kind of you get introduced to lots of things quickly. And
there's a mystery to this game,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, and you get thrust into
And you don't actually know where it's going.
Right. And like, it doesn't begin in the way the previous games have began.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
It begins with Soma and Mina going to a shrine in Japan, and it happens to be during an eclipse, and all of a sudden they wake up and they're in the castle, which is inside the eclipse, and they're like, what the hell is going on? And they're attacked by monsters, and Soma lashes out against one in desperation and consumes its soul and suddenly has the power to command it. And he's like, I don't know what's up with this, but I guess the only way for us to get out of here, according to this strange guy in a suit, is that I have to go like fight my way out. And so you start running around and trying to figure out what the mystery
is. That soul collection, I remember instantly, I was like, this is what I've always wanted in Castlevania. Yeah. It kind of gives you a little bit of Pokemon in your Castlevania in the best –
tactical soul system.
Oh, the best possible way. It gives you a reason to fight enemies over and over again. Besides experience,
yeah.
which this game also has.
And you know what they're going to drop. There's no mystery to it. You're
right.
Like, I want this soul.
I want the Valkyrie soul, so I will kill the Valkyrie.
Every enemy has a soul.
Yeah, pretty much. And then there are some souls that are, you know, like a one-time thing that are essential to the plot. And then others that you can just collect. And there's a New Game Plus element to this where you can start over.
There's multiple New Game
and
Plus
keep.
Elements.
Oh, yeah. But the best one is that you can keep all your souls – except the plot, plot-driven ones,
yeah.
And start over with like, you know, your level one experience, but you have all your equipment and all your souls, so you can just crush everything from the beginning.
And I think compared to the previous two games, which had the cool subsystems, here they had a lot more ingenuity with some of these souls, and some of them have really interesting visual effects and just creative gameplay effects. And
some of them are just goofy.
Yeah, and some of them are very difficult to get. There are some enemies that appear very rarely. There's like one enemy that
there's
only appears
Tsuchinoko.
Once. Right. That you mentioning that, it took me days of hunting that enemy to get that soul. And I have great memories of it.
Yeah, it's all very random. Like sometimes you'll kill an enemy and their soul will fly out and come into Soma. Most of the time that doesn't happen. Some enemies are much more common than others. Like the peeping eye does not want to give up its soul. But bats, you'll have a million of those.
Luck plays into it, and there's items you can equip to give you a better chance of dropping souls.
Yep. So you really it's a game that has benefits to playing around with different stats. Because your intelligence, you know, boosts the power of your souls. But maybe you want to drop your intelligence so you can build up your luck so that you can collect more energy. And also, Soma can use a couple of whips or whip-like items.
Yep.
But for the most part, he just has, you know, every other kind of weapon from short swords to broadswords to spears to handguns.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you can really kind of customize what you want. I love running around with a handgun because even though it's weak, you can just like pump enemies full of lead. You can also find secret rooms really easily that way by shooting walls.
I mean, as you spoke about in the 70 Night episode, like the incredible depth to the armory and all the things you can equip, like the shield rod. And this has a lot of that too. They definitely expanded on the amount of things you could find and equip compared to the previous portable games. A lot – and little touches, little things to discover, the secret little Easter eggs, the extra polish. You can tell his team had a lot more time on this game.
Right. And you can tell that they loved what they were doing because – you get, again, like those goofy things, like you can kill the waiter soul, the waiter skeleton,
mm-hmm.
and collect its soul, and that lets you throw plates of curry, which basically works like the
– oh, God. I love that one.
It works like, you know, kind of like holy water or the garlic or whatever.
Oh, wow.
Where
yeah.
enemies walk into it and they take, you know, recursive damage. Or you can kill Persephone, the maid, like the karate maid that you meet in Symphony of the Night for the first time, and her soul is it's like a skull-shaped vacuum cleaner,
right.
And you can run around and you can hit enemies with the vacuum cleaner.
That. That's awesome.
And it sucks up their life and gives it to you.
Yeah.
There's just like so many little tiny creative things.
Yeah, that's a Symphony of the Night silliness that I like. If you find it, it's really great.
And some of the souls have really unexpected benefits. Like there's a waterfall that you can pass through to get some hidden items. But if you try to run into it, some will be thrown back. And it doesn't seem like there's any passive ability that'll get you through that. But there's a couple of enemies that basically – they're like stands from JoJo's Bizarre Adventure and they like appear behind you and they cause you to go darting forward. There's Valkyrie and Devil and a couple of others, and those will push you through with enough speed and force that you can break through the yeah. waterfall. But you have to figure that out. There's just so much depth to this game and so many little things hidden. And then on top of that, it has a really interesting story, like a really – unexpected plot twist and actually a couple of plot twists.
Yeah, and more story than the previous games. There are more interjections. You meet more characters. You just feel more connected to what's happening.
And they do a good job of connecting to, you know, Castlevania lore. Like Yoko Belnades is descended from Sypha Belnades. Jay has an important part to play. Graham is not connected to the past, but he thinks that he's the reincarnation of Dracula. And so he becomes like Soma's rival because Soma has Dracula-like powers, which there's a reason for that. But
I mean, you know, we're glowing about this game. One of the criticisms I do have is, given the premise, it isn't quite as, you know, innovative with futuristic stuff in different environments. There is a little bit of, you know, repeated motifs from previous games here. And the level design, again, not as amazing as parts of Symphony of the Night. And, you know, it's hard to remember specific levels in this game compared to Symphony of the Night. But at the time, this was by far the apex. Like, you know, it was a must-have game. Like, you know, a 10 out of 10 for a lot of people.
Well, I like what Jay turns out to be, because he looks very Dracula-esque with his mustache and his beard. He's like an older man. Even though he's got kind of reddish hair, you're like, is this guy Dracula? Because he's running around and kind of keeps threatening Soma. And then there's Graham, who wears all white and seems to be like a nice guy until kind of later on he starts to feel threatened by Soma and gets a little mean. But then it turns out Jay is Julius Belmont, who sealed Dracula and then lost his memory because of the stress of the battle. And Graham is a guy who thinks he's Dracula but isn't, because Dracula is actually Soma. And Soma is kind of like a second chance for Dracula to determine his course. Like, does he become evil or does he live a more righteous life?
Oh, that leads to the fantastic bad ending of this game.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Talk about it.
Well, if you don't have the proper stuff to move forward, the main character ends up becoming Dracula. And it's like
this
ultimately bad, depressing ending. And it was the first one I got. And I was like, oh, man. he could just like went full dark on me. I love it.
Yeah. And the second game actually does – the sequel does an even better job with that. But You can play as Jay. There's like Julius mode. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of continues that. There is no second castle to this game. Like I think they decided, you know, maybe that's not what we want to do. It was kind of a development shortcut in Symphony of the Night. Like, let's expand the game by turning our assets upside down. And this one, what they do is they basically reveal like a hidden area that you can go to. It's sort of like the secret heart of the castle. And it's not that big, but it is something you can only reveal by completing the right conditions. And you have to fight Julius and beat him with the right conditions equipped, I think. Or do you have to fight Graham with the right – I think you have to fight Graham with the right
souls. And then when you do that, then you can unlock – play as Julius. And that's a bit like the Richter mode of the previous games, where he's a more traditional strong character. But he does level up in this one, or is that in Dawn of Sorrow?
It's been a while since I played that.
One of them – okay, maybe it's Dawn of Sorrow, where he – because I think it's pretty hard to make it through with him. I did it though, because it's worth it, because there's more stuff to unlock in this game.
So yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to belabor the point, but this game just – does a great job of –
well, you also – I mean, you can play as Alucard. You can play as Arcado in this. Or is that in Dawn of Sorrow?
No, that's not Dawn of Sorrow.
Okay,
we'll talk about that later. Yeah.
Yes, and all of these games we talked about are on the Wii U Virtual Console, and I think they look good on a TV. I wasn't disgusted by them.
How much should they cost on there?
They're $7.99.
Wow, that's
good. Yeah, that's good for all of these. I mean,
yeah, Aria of Sorrow, if you try to buy that as a cartridge, is very expensive.
Yes, it is. I tried to buy it for my girlfriend.
Even the double pack is very expensive.
Oh, right. There was a double pack with Harmony. Is it on one cartridge?
It is, yeah.
It is on one, yeah.
That's the one that I have. I kind of wish I had kept the original versions, but I was like, ah.
How much would that cost complete these days?
I think it's like – how much did you pay? Didn't you get that for Dora? Like,
oh, I bought it from Kohler, but it was a like loose cart. Right? And I think it was like $70, something like
that.
For
the loose?
Just for the loose cart.
Yeah. Oh my God.
That's
– Are you saying Chris Kohler ripped me off? He's coming in here today.
No, it's probably
about right.
It's probably a good deal.
Yeah.
Non-pirated Game Boy Advance games are kind of hard to come by now.
They are, yeah.
Oh, do we say with the Japanese title? Isn't this like Minuet of Dawn?
It is, yeah.
Yeah. It's a good one.
So I think that's probably all there is to say about Aria. I think we should take a break now and come back and talk about the DS games.
Life is full of those moments. Like right after that first stretch and yawn in the morning.
Yeah.
Or like standing in the forest alone amid the stillness. The beauty hits you like the crisp air and suddenly everything makes sense and you're one with the earth and stars. Or like dollar drinks at McDonald's.
Keep those ah moments going with $1 any size McCafe brewed coffee and $1 any size soft drinks on the $1, $2, $3 dollar menu. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with combo meal.
Hey everyone, it's time for some words from our sponsors. So, I don't want to alarm anyone, but the latest word from NASA is that a massive invasion force of alien warbots is en route to Earth. These metal warbots mean business, and they laugh at the creature comforts of humanity. You know, luxuries like soft mattresses and reasonable prices. In other words, our future robot overlords scoff at the idea of something like a Casper mattress, even though they have a lot in common. Casper mattresses are made of two high-tech materials, latex foam and memory foam, working in perfect unison, just like the warbots' titanium-bonded steel exoframes. And just as their dread mechano-general has won countless medals for the conquest of worlds, Casper is now the most awarded mattress of the decade. On the other hand, while warbots pose a terrible threat to all life on Earth, Casper mattresses are risk-free, offering a painless 100-day trial period, free shipping, and easy returns. A warbot costs billions to manufacture, while Casper mattresses start at $500 for twins and a mere $950 for a sprawling California king-size mattress. On top of that, you can get a $50 credit toward the purchase of any mattress by visiting caspertrial.com/game and using the promo code 50SLEEP. Terms and conditions apply, obviously. There's no stopping the warbot invasion force, but shouldn't the final nights of our time as a free species be spent on the comfort of a Casper mattress?
Okay, here are some really surprising car facts for you. In Churchill, Canada, residents leave their cars unlocked. That's in case someone needs to escape a polar bear. It's true. And in Sweden, drivers are required by law to keep their headlights on at all times. Day, night, rain, sunshine, doesn't matter. And now, here's another interesting and actually helpful thing about cars that you might not know. TrueCar also helps people get used cars. That's right. TrueCar isn't just for new cars. Their certified dealer network also has an inventory of over 700,000 pre-owned cars nationwide. So whether you're looking for a new or used car, you can get real pricing on actual inventory and a better buying experience through the TrueCar certified dealer network. Oh yeah, here's another fun fact. TrueCar customers can see if they're getting a good or great price before they buy. They're also more likely to enjoy a faster buying process when they connect with their TrueCar certified dealers. So when you're ready to buy that car, new or used, visit TrueCar and enjoy a better car buying experience. Some features not available in all states.
This week's episode of Retronauts is also sponsored in part by BarkBox. I know what you're thinking, but Jeremy, I see trees everywhere I go. Why would I need a huge box of bark shipped to me each month? But see, that's the thing about the English language, all those tricky homophones. BarkBox is about dogs, not trees. It's a monthly service that ships a box of all-natural, edible treats and interesting toys to your four-legged pal. Sign up at getbarkbox.com/game, customize your plan to your dog's needs, whether they're a tiny, medium, or jumbo-sized pooch, have specific allergy or health issues, and more. And BarkBox will send you a different themed box of puppy goods on the 15th of each month, with free shipping in the continental U.S. BarkBox only ships edibles made in the U.S. and Canada, often from small businesses that don't yet have other means of wide distribution. So each month's new box is unique. And if your dog ever gets confused and thinks it's a cat and gets all finicky about some of their goodies, BarkBox will even send a substitute item in return. And Retronauts listeners can get a free bonus month of service by signing up for a 6 or 12 month trial by going to getbarkbox.com/game.
Mitch LaFon here. Please check out my new podcast, Rock Talk with Mitch LaFon, every Monday on the Jericho Network here at Podcast One. I'll be talking to all the biggest names in rock, including Andy Summers from The Police, Poison, Night Ranger, Loverboy, and a lot more. Download new episodes each Monday via PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, or simply subscribe via iTunes.
Hey, Retronauts listeners, it's me, Jeremy. I know you love my monotone drone, but you only get a couple of hours of it every week. Why not fill the other 166 of them with the next best thing? Professionally read audiobooks courtesy of Audible. With 180,000 different books available, Audible literally has more great literature available than you could physically cram into an entire lifetime, even if you listened at double speed. Right now, Audible is offering Retronauts listeners a free audiobook download and a free 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/game. That includes contemporary hits and literary classics alike. Classics like George Orwell's 1984, the totally fictional and not at all realistic tale of a fascistic government that uses perpetual war, invasive surveillance, and a wanton disregard for truth to oppress its citizenry. Everyone loves a little lighthearted escapism, right? It's another 160 hours or so until the next full episode of Retronauts drops. So fill the empty space in your life until then by downloading a free audiobook and trying out the trial at audibletrial.com/game.
Hello, everyone. It's the second half of this podcast.
And are you Boris Karloffis?
I think it was Count von Count.
Count von Count. Do you know why they called me the Count? Because I love to count. We are on the fourth game.
Already?
That's more like Adam Sandler directing. Sorry about that. My apologies.
We're off of the old GBA.
Yep. It's time to move on to Nintendo DS, which is where the title Dawn of Sorrow comes from, because everyone did that gimmick, including Castlevania.
How clever.
Also, but
they had it built in. They had Aria of Sorrow, so it was natural for them to say, well, this is actually the second game, and it's not the Dawn, but whatever. We'll just call it Dawn of Sorrow.
While not necessarily relevant, it is important to consider between what we just talked about and this one, Iga and his team did make a game called Lament of Innocence for the PlayStation 2, which will probably include in some future podcast. Yeah. So this is his return to the 2D Castlevania realm.
And his 3D Castlevania continued the trend of not being that great.
But it tried. It's slightly misunderstood. It has some good – we'll talk about stuff I like. Some other time, yeah.
But it's one that I've never gotten around to finishing because it just has a lot of
problems. Oh, it has a good last boss. Anyway. I think we should do a micro on Nano Breaker to spend that other. Maybe so I'll pay. Oh, how much would that cost me on Patreon if I
Nano Breaker?
If I want to do a Nano Breaker,
like $1,000.
Like Che Chow still calls me Nano Breaker sometimes because I like it.
That's what you get for calling me T Frog. So anyway, we skip ahead 2 years from Aria of Sorrow to the Dawn of Sorrow, and 2 years brings a change in hardware. The Nintendo DS had launched in 2004. And this game actually came out right around the time that the DS started to become a serious contender. There was, you know, like the first year or so between announcement and launch and then sort of the follow-up to Nintendogs. Everyone was like, what is this thing Nintendo's doing?
There wasn't a lot of content that proved the form factor yet. Like, why am I looking at two screens?
Right. Yeah. Okay, I can rub some rabbits. That's nice.
I mean, I got mine in the fall of 2005 because of things like Mario Kart, Phoenix Wright, just all these great games were happening at once.
Right. I have a soft spot for Dawn of Sorrow because I was the voice of dissent, maybe at Ziff Davis.
Voice of Descent sounds like a Castlevania game.
descent of stupidity. So I was the voice of dissent, at least at 1UP and maybe at Ziff Davis, to say like, no, I like the DS. I want the system to do well.
You liked it at the very beginning.
I did.
Not
quite the very beginning. Like
Super Mario 64 is not so hot on it.
No.
That's a problem.
It's not.
One of the greatest games of all time.
I made some people angry by giving that like a 7.5 out of 10. But
that's a little high, I think. Because I think we were wary, but everyone loved this game.
I talked about this on the DS podcast, the retrospective. But
the PSP kids were so cool.
When the DS came out, I was like, oh, what a weird little system. I'm going to support this and, you know, I'm going to get the dozen games that come out for it before it goes away.
You bought Ping Pals.
But then I did not do that. I didn't go that far. But no, like after a month after it came out, I took it with me on vacation to visit my family and my young cousins played it. And I saw them interacting with the touch and was like they just wanted to play the Mario 64 minigames. Mm-hmm. And I realized like, okay, I need to take myself out of the games press mindset because we're all a bunch of cynical, jaded jerks. Kids get this. This, if they can make this, you know, work with the kid audience, this will go really far. And they managed to do that. But Dawn of Sorrow is the point at which, in addition to getting these kid-friendly franchises on there and these like little kind of goofy diversions, you also got really substantial follow-ups to games that we, the games press type people, liked.
Well, and also when you think about Castlevania Symphony of the Night and its children, one of the obvious things is, man, I like to look at that map. And hey, the second screen, what a good use of the second screen. So it just – it lent itself to the format.
Yeah, the GBA couldn't do the overlay approach to the map that Symphony of the Night did, so you had to go to like a subscreen. But yeah, Dawn of Sorrow, all of a sudden you could just have the map on the bottom screen, and right. that was nice. But also the GBA had higher resolution and a lot more hardware power than the GBA.
And better sound processing too.
Yep. Yep. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden you had a game that wasn't quite technically on par with Symphony of the Night, but it was close. The sprites were much bigger. The music was much, much better than anything. Like Aria had good music, but it was very constrained by the hardware. This music sounded great.
It
great
does.
Compositions and great output.
Mm. The one
it had
agree,
a much
though.
Like a much larger kind of castle. It just felt bigger, roomier, more fast paced. Yeah,
right.
It was great.
Right, and also jump in. Like after the disappointment of Lament of Innocence, everybody was eager to return to the thing we really liked.
We were eager.
We were eager to return to, and they gave us what we want. You rarely get the thing you want. We got exactly the thing we want.
Yeah, I mean the one downgrade that which you listed here is the character designs, which I think is not actually reflected in the sprite art, but it is in the portrait art and on the cover.
Can I say that was the first problem? Like one of the first things you saw was the main character image, and it was the same character, but in a much more anime traditional kind of generic. Style.
Yeah, like very of the early 2000s sort of anime.
Looked
look.
Younger for a younger audience.
Yeah, and it was very definitely meant to be sort of like a mainstream approach. And the story was dumbed down considerably. It had like – you had more villains, but they were all just like generic anime tropes like the guy with red hair who has a fiery temper. Like, oh, come on. Really? Yeah. So the story wasn't as good, but the bonus game was great.
Well, and
there was one other problem with this game, which is that it was an early DS game.
Oh, yeah.
And they were like, it's not enough to have a second screen that lets you see a map. We need to make use of touch mechanics too. So, yeah,
so
there's the seal effect.
Yeah, shoehorned in is kind of a rudimentary, you know, trace this – you know, simple image on the bottom screen.
It's a memory thing, though. You see the tracing happen, and then you have to actually replicate it without, you know, seeing it in front of you.
Right.
Yeah.
And you can go and practice it and rehearse, but it's really frustrating because you have to collect the seals, and you can't open a boss door until you have the proper seal. And it'll show you the seal, like the direction to draw. It's like tracing kanji, basically. Like stroke order is important. And then when you get the boss down to like a tiny fraction of its health, instead of landing a death blow directly, instead the seal comes up and you have to seal the boss away by drawing on the bottom screen.
Within a time limit, right?
Within a time limit. And it's no problem for the first couple of seals, which have like three strokes. But at the end, you're doing like these really intricate.
There you go.
Good Lord. Endocrine. You're doing these really endocrine intricate seals like pentagrams and much more complicated than that. And you have very little time.
Right.
There's like a little – like little balls of fire around the rim of the seal that click down.
Yeah, having to grab the stylus because, you know, it's sometimes they got more complicated.
No. Okay, so it doesn't actually start the countdown until you touch the touch screen.
Yeah.
So like it'll freeze and you can, you know, take – 10, 20 seconds to grab the stylus.
Okay.
Once you start drawing, then you have to complete it in time.
I think I only remember failing like three times the entire time I played
this
game.
But it's like the later bosses, which are really tough.
Yeah.
And if you don't complete the seal correctly in time, then they regenerate like a quarter of their health and you have to keep fighting them.
It's true.
Yeah. At least you don't have to blow into the DS. I've always hated that. Nintendo kept doing it as late as Spirit Tracks and things like that. It's awful.
Yeah. There is that. But – so those two problems, the anime art style and the seals, are really the only complaints I have about this game. Otherwise, it takes the Aria of Sorrow style and mechanics and makes it like, you know, blows it up from PS or from GBA quality to PS1 quality.
Well, and specifically, the mechanic of the soul system is greatly enhanced by allowing you to power up some of the souls by collecting multiple souls.
Pretty much all of them. You can just keep grinding for souls and make them stronger.
I guess I remember just some of them have much more different visual effects. Like we brought up the curry skeleton. In this one, when you max out the curry skeleton, you feel like this giant
old it's like a whole tray of food. So none of this is mandatory. You don't have to power up any of the souls, but you can. There's also the ability to sacrifice some of your souls to power up your weapons. And there are some kind of hard to come by one-time souls that you can choose to bond into a weapon. But if you do that, then you won't be able to use that soul again. So there's a real trade-off, and you can't be a completist without, you know, doing the new game plus. And I'm okay with that. Like, it's interesting. It forces you to make, you know, to make decisions. It's not just like a cruise through and collect everything like Symphony of the Night was. Right. Like there are some trade-offs and some decisions you have to make. So it's pretty interesting. And the castle itself, I think, is much more memorable. The areas are much more distinct than they were in Aria. You have like the big cathedral area. You have like a crazy underground lab, which has really unusual, like kind of funky rock music.
Right.
That's not typical to Castlevania.
And the very last part of this game is spectacular. Did you remember the end game? Like the last levels of this game?
Where you go into the void?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it's possibly my favorite level.
Talk about it.
Well, it's been so long since I played it, but I just remember being like hellish and abstract and strange and like going places like almost like an Evangelion kind of place, you know, like really going surreal in a way that Castlevania had not gone previously.
Right. And in this game, you don't fight Dracula at the end because you are Dracula. Instead, you fight Chaos, which is like three screens high.
Right.
And doesn't it like steal some of your souls away?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. So it kind of reminds me of the Final Fantasy VIII final battle
right,
where you're
right.
like losing your abilities and you have to – you know, compensate for that.
Yeah, I just felt like Iga and his team threw everything. They like really decided to like go all out in a way that everyone wanted. And this game just like, you know, if you were a fan of Symphony and Aria of Sorrow, this is like, you know,
right.
the end of that trilogy almost.
Right. And people are like complaining about recycled sprites. No, this game does so much. It's okay. Let them reuse some assets. It's
right.
fine.
But
look
yeah.
at all the other things this game does. There's so much.
Yep.
And then if you get the bad ending – it's so good because, yes, Soma becomes Dracula, but you don't just play as Julius. You play like non-linear Castlevania 3 where you play as Julius and Yoko and Alucard.
Right.
And I think they were originally planning to make Hammer
yeah.
play like
Grant.
And
Yoko,
cut that out.
And Yoko
still,
has like Sypha's power.
Yoko
yeah.
is Sypha. Yeah.
yeah. And having to play Alucard again is just fantastic as well. It really over-delivers on the end game content, the bonus content.
So good. Yeah, that bonus stage, it's worth getting the bad ending just because that's so well done. It's such a love letter to Castlevania.
So the GPA games are on Virtual Console for the Wii U, but none of the DS games are. Are these rare? I want to play this again, but I have a feeling it's hard to come
by.
Really? Okay.
I think this had like a greatest hits re-release even.
Okay.
It did. In America,
like,
and Japan.
The game box art inside the game box.
It's like an Inception.
Art.
It's like a box in a box in a box. Yeah.
Exactly.
This is in – you know, like I often think about like if I combined Aria and this into one experience, it's definitely my favorite Castlevania.
I think these sold well enough that they're not super rare. Now,
okay.
I know Order of Ecclesia is not – it's not an expensive game, which
oh,
I thought would be because
yeah,
it was so
too.
Late in
the lifestyle. Portrait is going up, I believe.
Is it? Mm-hmm. I mean, these are going to get expensive at some point.
This is the one I don't have. Mm-hmm. I don't
But the
own
DS
anyway.
Market hasn't quite taken off yet.
Yeah.
So
yeah, you should get this.
I'm buying low right now, yeah.
Games. Yeah. Like, they're worth having. Do you have them?
I have every one but this one.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is so good.
Yeah.
Have you
yeah.
played it before?
Oh, yeah. I beat it when it came out.
Okay.
So,
good
God, I want to go back to it now. It's the one I didn't play for this show.
Yeah, so I agree with you, Shane. This does feel like sort of the culmination of a trilogy. And the two games that followed after this were both very different in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I felt like he didn't want to repeat himself again, so he actually did some new things. And there's some successes and failures we'll talk about.
Yeah. So yeah, the next year, can you believe these games came out once a year?
We
How
were
spoiled,
so spoiled
were we? Oh my God.
And this is where I was like, I'm okay with Castlevania for now. I'll just put you aside. And
well,
I didn't realize
yeah.
it would no longer be annual.
And I'll say when we get to Portrait, it is – even though it's very different, when things reappear from previous games, this is when, as reviewers, we started to bemoan like, well, I like this boss, but I sure fought him a lot of times.
Yeah, Frankenstein is back, baby.
Yeah, but every time it was different. Oh, anyway. So Portrait of Ruin is the next game. And this game, It doesn't set the series forward, but it doesn't go way back into the past either. It's set in the 20th century, well, right after World War II.
So Iga wanted to kind of revisit bloodlines with mm-hmm. this game.
And he did.
And he did.
Literally.
Yeah, and it kind of, you know, of the time, and the characters are different. It has that different feel than the previous three games.
Yeah, I mean, if Symphony of the Night was a sequel to Rondo of Blood, this is the sequel to Bloodlines. And it doesn't – it's not obvious at first, but the more you play, the more the plot elements come in.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you remember Bloodlines had two different protagonists back in the day, two mm-hmm. characters. And also this is the game where like kind of the zeitgeist of the moment was multiplayer. So there's a little bit of that kind of injected into this game.
But also like, you know, Bloodlines, the point was to travel across Europe to all of Castlevania or all of Dracula's different lairs. And this game, even though it has like a central castle that you're exploring – you journey out into other places. So it really does kind of capture that sense of like, you know, traveling around the world.
Right.
Although in this case, you're not literally traveling around the world. You're traveling into paintings. So it's kind of like Mario 64.
Yeah. Yeah. But I remember some of the earliest stuff we saw was like kind of Egyptian themed, and that seemed really fresh. You mm-hmm. know?
Yeah. Yeah. So they did try to do a lot with this. You can kind of see the budget limitations coming in the second half, where four more portraits appear and you have to fight through them, and they're just like variants of the first four portraits.
But I remember you do fight the first bosses of Castlevania remade there, which is kind of cool. You know, it's like that there's some fan service.
Yeah, but you did that in Symphony of the Night too.
That's true.
So I think it's fair to say that they were kind of struggling for some inspiration and working against their budget limitations. But there is also a lot to love about Portrait of Ruin. It's an even better looking game than Dawn of Sorrow.
There's more 3D elements in the backgrounds, I remember.
It's new kind of environments, and they're all done really beautifully. Like the village that you go through, you have like all these shops and stuff, and they're just loaded with details. And, you know, there's crazy little elements you can play with. Like you jump up on these platforms that are, you know, like pantry shelves, mm-hmm. and little things fall off because you're knocking them loose. And you can go into a butcher shop and beat up the pieces of meat hanging. There's just lots of little details. Hmm. But the most important element of this game, the thing that makes it distinct, is that you're playing as two characters. There's Jonathan.
He plays like a Belmont.
Is he Jonathan Morris?
I think maybe he is, because that's kind of
it's getting that Morris Baldwin thing.
He's
again.
Kind of the more traditional Belmont style character,
right?
Yeah,
he is very much a Belmont. He's like not a Belmont directly, but he's like a cousin of the family.
Yeah,
and then there's
the young lady
Charlotte Allen,
and I think that's where most of the ingenuity is in her gameplay and mm-hmm. how you use the two characters as a single player to solve puzzles.
Right.
Yeah.
Early in the game, you gain the ability to call in a second character and have them fight along with you as an AI-controlled character. So you get like Charlotte, who fights with a very weak melee attack but has a ton of magic spells.
Yeah, things pop out of a book, right?
If she gets hurt. If the other player gets hurt, does it cost you like magic points?
Like a weapon or an item you can equip. Mm. You do lose magic points if your character, the second character, is hurt, but you can change it so you lose health instead.
Yeah, but it's something useful on bosses. I remember it was a cool mechanic.
Yeah. So learning to use each character in the right context and learning when you need to use them together, when you need to use them separately, just one character at a time, that all becomes really important. Like one of the most clever elements of the game, there's a few enemies in the game that interact differently with the characters. Mm-hmm. There's the kind of like the fat guy in the pantaloons in the Lost Village early on. And if he sees Jonathan, he'll attack. But if he sees Charlotte, then he drops to one knee and offers her a rose, and he's completely defenseless. Like he won't attack Charlotte.
And so there's a female villain too. Yeah.
There's
a
boss. Yes. Yeah. I put her name down. Astarte. She's the Egyptian goddess.
Yeah.
You have to get Jonathan out of there because she has a magic spell that will charm Jonathan and cause him to go berserk and fight for her. Mm. So if you're playing as Jonathan, you lose complete control. If you're playing a Charlotte with Jonathan in the background, then Jonathan starts attacking you and you will basically lose because he's really powerful. So you have to fight this this goddess, this Egyptian goddess, solo as Charlotte. Otherwise, it's really difficult. And the secret of unlocking the true ending to the game also revolves around knowing which character to use and basically, you have to be Charlotte and you have to cast this really powerful magic spell that takes a long time to cast. So you need Jonathan to run around behind you as an AI and sort of back you up and defend you. So they do a really good job of kind of making you change up how you play and the approach you take to these two characters. So that part I think works really, really well.
There was less customization of the characters though than we'd seen in Aria and Dawn. And I think for me it did feel like a step back or like a simplification on purpose kind of.
Yeah, I mean you know, because you had two characters, like it kind of divided up their customization.
Right.
But I mean, Jonathan could equip all kinds of weapons. You know, ultimately he has to learn to use the vampire killer whip.
Right.
And there's a pretty cool like cutscene – or not cutscene but set piece battle that you have to mm-hmm. do that.
Well, and her abilities were so creative. I remember one like she would like summon Don Quixote to come out of her book, you know, like
– yeah. Jonathan has a ton of sub-weapons he can acquire. Like he can use all the different kind of weapon styles that Alucard can in addition to the whip. But you also have tons and tons of sub-weapons. Like I think there's like 30.
Hmm.
So in addition to, you know, the holy water and the axe, you can also get really goofy things like paper airplanes. And
I remember that one. That was good.
You know, you can throw the curry from the waiter skeleton and so forth. And each of these abilities you collect, the more you use them, the more powerful they become. So each of them has its own like experience tracking system. So the more you use one, the more powerful it becomes. But it's not too hard to max them out. So it behooves you to switch things around, especially if you want to do the completionist style and just get 100% on everything. So there are a lot of play opportunities in this game and a lot of customization, a lot of incentive to vary up how you play.
You know, despite the breadth of the game where you're like going to these different places, it does feel a little shorter though, remember? Like it doesn't feel like a huge adventure, and the first half of the game has more new creative content than the back half of the game too.
Right,
By the time you fight Legion, you're like, what's he doing here?
The back half is very much like the second castle of Symphony of the Night. It's the first half of the game sort of remixed. And that's okay. Like it's still a pretty substantial game.
Did Igarashi ever make any statements about the development of this game and any kind of compromises that had to be made? I'm just curious if he's spoken on the record about it.
You know,
I don't think so.
Back in the day, you know, he was trying some new things. He was very excited to go back to like the Genesis Castlevania style and the interplay of the two characters. And the multiplayer, I don't really remember it, but there was a local
sort of like the boss rush mode that was multiplayer.
You can do like a shop where you can sell things to people.
Yeah, but it felt tacked on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember – like,
I didn't care.
I think there was resources wasted on the multiplayer potentially. But you know, I did like this game. But it, you know, coming from Dawn of Sorrow, it was kind of the inevitable slight letdown.
Well, I appreciate the fact that they dropped the touchscreen element of Dawn of Sorrow until you get to the bonus mode.
Right.
You can – you know, as with every Castlevania developed by Igarashi, you can play once you beat the game as a second character. In this case, you're playing as the two sisters who are like demi vampires who
right.
you fight. And they turn out – it turns out that they are the daughters of one of the characters from Bloodlines who is sort of a ghost who's been killed in Dracula's castle who helps guide you along. But you can play as the sisters and they control entirely by the stylus. And it's really cool because they're vampires, so they float. So you control them based on, you know, flying around, and you can – one of them has like a projectile attack and the other like uses telekinesis basically. So you can like do all these crazy physics things with enemies that you didn't even know existed. Like, you know, I blogged once about how I made a little game out of trying to – see how much distance I could get out of zombies by cutting them in half, and like
that's great.
Their upper halves would go flying.
That was fun. I kind of forgot about that, but that was interesting, unlockable for sure.
Yeah. So they definitely put a lot of love into this game.
Was this the one that the soundtrack was not by Amane, or was it the next one? One of them
is the next one.
It's the next one. Okay, yeah,
this one was actually Michiru Yamane and also Yuzo Koshiro.
Right. Okay.
This got some great Koshiro.
Some good
games.
Remixes of old stuff too.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this was the 20th anniversary. They released that box set, that really huge box set of
right.
Castlevania. Music too, right?
Yeah.
Good stuff.
I just remember at the time I was playing this, I just ran into it through Gamefly. I didn't play for long, but I did remember annoying my girlfriend at the time by when you switch characters, they say the other one's name. So I was like, Jonathan. Yeah. So just doing that back and forth until she'd be like, shut up. So that's my main memory of this game. I need to go back and revisit it. I played it a little bit for this, but The next game is one I just feel everyone is down about. I don't even know if I want to play it.
No, Nick. So while preparing for this.
I really want to beat this game. But.
So while preparing for this podcast, this was the one that I kind of remembered the least because it was the last one. But then as I was like looking at.
That doesn't make any sense. It's the most recent one.
I know. But like it feels like a long time. I don't know. For whatever reason. And that goes towards the end of my editorial career when I reviewed this. And a lot has happened since this in the world of Metroidvanias, as we kind of talked about.
That's
so
true.
Like while revisiting, I was like, oh man, this one. In many ways has some of the best moments of any Egovania. Some of the boss battles, like the first major boss battle in this game, is so good. So very, very good. So much more dramatic and kind of like directed. Like he brought a different perspective to this game, but he also pared it down considerably. And in many ways, because I'm a Simon's Quest fan, I feel like this one is kind of a weird spiritual successor to Simon's Quest.
Yeah, all of Iga's games kind of touch back on an older Castlevania, and this one very much was Simon's Quest. There's a village, and you're basically going on quests to find the people who have been kidnapped from the village and bring them back. And so that kind of becomes your central hub, and everything is connected by a map that looks exactly like the Castlevania 2 map in Nintendo Power, like 100%.
Well,
it's crazy.
And the fact that map exists, and you know, it's kind of weird because like Metroidvania has always been about this, you know, kind of coherent, diegetic world that's all interconnected. And suddenly there's like this weird map in front of you after all these games. But it does show you that you're going to go to these different places and that some of the levels are very small compared to what you're going to expect. So
some of them are just like a pass-through almost.
Yeah, it kind of mixes up the formula and you don't – as a traditional Castlevania fan, you don't know what to expect. And also
– but they kind of built on Portrait of Ruin, which – you know, gave you the castle as a central hub, but then gave you 8 levels that were self-contained.
Right. And I think one of the criticisms of hardcore Castlevania fans through these 5 games had been they seemed to be getting easier and easier and easier. And this game is hard.
It's hard as balls.
Like it takes away many of the things you're used to being able to kind of just farm and have infinite life. And
And
the bosses in general are new and difficult.
Reading reviews about this game, it seems the difficulty was just inflated hit points. Really, there was sort of just a not very creative way to add difficulty to a game, just sort of inflating hit points.
Yeah, the boss battles are very long.
Yeah.
Incredibly long.
Well, I mean, part of it, there is an attribute system to your souls. You don't have physical weapons.
The glyph
system. Yeah, the glyph system, which is very much like the tactical soul system.
But this is the first Castlevania in a very long time with a female protagonist.
It's true.
Only,
yeah. Shanoa. It doesn't have any Belmonts in it. It's all kind of like this this order of Ecclesia, the people who have like sworn to take on Dracula on their own terms without, you know, using the Belmont's enchantments.
And it's clearly less whimsical, less fanciful than the previous 4 games.
Yeah, it goes back away from the anime character portrait style to – it's not Ayami Kojima.
It's a different female artist and it's quite good.
It's very nice. Yeah. And it's by far the best looking Castlevania game, period. Like the backgrounds – Oh my god, they're so beautiful. And Shinoa's animation is so good.
I know I'm skipping ahead, but they kind of gave us new sprites. It's like when you – it's like, oh my god, a new Medusa sprite. Holy hell.
Yeah, there's a lot of new stuff. It really does feel like sort of the culmination of Castlevania, but it is very difficult because your glyph system – your glyphs have attributes. So like there's piercing, there's crushing.
You know what this game is? Vagrant Story Castlevania.
A little bit. I mean, it's, you know, like traditional RPG. Like RPGs have those attributes.
Think about it. If you don't have the right attributes, you're fighting a boss, you're doing 1 point of damage.
Yeah, basically. And even against normal enemies. Like when you first – I've been replaying a little bit. And when you first get the Massus glyph, which is a hammer, like that's great against skeletons. All of a sudden you're doing 50% more damage against skeletons. But there's these like horrible little things that fly around in the woods and will swoop down and grab you and suck your life away. And if you try to hit them with a hammer – you do like 2 hit points of damage, whereas the stabbing attack does like 15. So you really have to know which glyphs to use.
Yeah, there's more strategy, more preparation.
But even with the right glyphs, it can be really tedious. The bosses, like I get what they were trying to do, but it kind of reminds me of the last battle, Circle of the Moon, where it's just a battle of attrition and you have to keep doing the right thing over and over again. It's such a grind.
Well, and I think a lot of people were so discouraged by how difficult it was, they didn't actually get to the back half of the game, which is Castlevania.
Right.
I mean, there's this amazing
– I've never been there.
Oh, wow, you're missing out. Cause like,
I know. I've heard it's great.
There's this cutscene of like, you know, Shinoa like arriving at Castlevania and then like when you get there, it is the first level of Castlevania and you really want it. You've earned it, you know?
Right. No, I mean I want to love this game. I swear to God I'm going
to
finish it.
God, they should be an HD remake or something. That'd be rad.
I don't know. I think part of what makes it great is that it is that
2D, 16-bit looking, like, you know, PlayStation era hand-drawn art. It's just such great colors, such great detail everywhere. I mean, it's, you know, Ecclesia itself is like this sort of like a cathedral almost. Yeah. And everything is just so ornate and detailed. It's very, you know, like medieval Baroque. I love it. It's such a great looking game.
I think this game was a little misunderstood at the time. And I know a lot of people didn't finish it like you. And I think it's ripe for reappraisal.
Yeah, again, I don't dislike it. I want to love it. And it really, really pushes me away, but I'm determined. I swear to God, by the time it turns 10, I'm going to have finished it. That's next year or so.
Yeah, I mean, were the sales poor? Were they just not what they wanted them to be? I'm just curious as to why this would be the final.
I think the DS market at this point had turned into like dump bins. You know, yeah. There were just so many games. Yeah. Like, yeah.
Yeah, this came out right before the big 2009 glut.
Right.
And 2009 was also the year that the iPhone started playing games. So
I forgot, yeah.
Yeah, so that was just bad news. So this was basically the end of Castlevania. There were a couple of games after. There was Harmony of Despair,
multiplayer 360
online,
PS3.
Which is interesting and fun, but it's not a new Castlevania.
And if you like recycled sprites, wait till you see them blown up to fill your entire screen.
Yes. Yeah. You can cut yourself on those.
I mean, basically, and there was also Castlevania Judgment. So like everything.
And there's also the interesting one for WiiWare. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Rebirth.
Which is good.
It's okay.
It's worth playing.
But yeah, this was definitely a period of Igarashi trying really hard to do a lot with very little money. Konami was not giving him a lot of money for projects, which is why you get stuff like Judgment.
Well, and also like these games were selling a few tens of thousands of copies in Japan, but a ton of copies in the West, you know, in Europe and in South America and in North America. And if you think about it now, in retrospect, it was the salad days of Castlevania. We had five really great Castlevanias in like a short amount of time. You know, it's pretty amazing.
We mentioned Judgment in passing. It was a Wii fighting game, correct?
It was.
With
art
by the Death Note artist.
We'll talk about that in like the Castlevania Bastards episode.
I just wanted to point that out. That happened.
It's
like,
weird.
That actually happened.
Art by Death Note guy, developed by A-Ting. It's best left forgotten, really, though.
8-4 did it, though, right?
They did.
They did.
They did their best.
They only localized it. They didn't make the game. So.
Right.
Their hands are clean.
But yeah, this is basically the end of true Castlevania at this point. And so now Igarashi has left Konami because that place is a shit show. And he's making his own successor to Castlevania, Bloodstained Ritual of the Night, which is – I mean, I played it last year at E3 and it is – it's basically like the follow-on to Order of Ecclesia.
It feels like Castlevania. I have the demo that they released for backers.
Yeah. Okay,
it feels
like
Castlevania.
Right. And I think already it looks a lot more encouraging than my number 9.
And they're pushing it back to 2018
for the best
instead of just rushing it out this year, which I'm fine with. I can wait another year for a great Castlevania game.
We've waited this long. Yeah. I mean, was Igarashi, the only thing he worked on that was released in this period, was that Lead Me's? Was that the only thing he actually produced between this and leaving Konami?
He did the Proteus for Xbox 360.
Oh, okay.
That was like his game.
Automedius?
Automedius.
Okay.
It's quite good.
Mm.
It's good. And he worked. he helped out with some other projects. He did some mobile stuff. But I think in a related time for this era too, like, you know, just to touch on, I think, you know, Metroid Zero Mission and Metroid Fusion of this were also, you know, similar in quality to these games of on the same
And then
time.
We never got a DS Metroid.
Right.
In like the
of,
real
of this era.
Metroids,
and I think it wasn't until many years later with games such as Axiom Verge, Guacamelee, you know, where we saw things of this quality again in this genre.
Yeah, I think the next Castlevania-esque game that we can look forward to is Chasm. Which has been in development for a long time.
Another good one, Heartforth Alesia. It's a little more like Mail, but it's also
I've backed
good.
Both of those on Kickstarter.
But so now this genre has been embraced by the indies, by people of our generation and younger who know what's great about these games and can spend time working on a passion project. So I feel like
the evangelism I did at 1UP finally paid off.
Right, yeah. Like, I feel like Iga ultimately gave this amazing genre to the fans. And as a fan himself, it's like I could – you know, I think everyone's better off with this.
All right, so that wraps it up for our discussion. I have some reader mail.
Oh, before we get to that, I want to add one thing. When I was listening to your episode about Rondo of Blood, there was a lot of question about that game's director and how this game came to be. And you mentioned his name is Toru Hagiwara. It looks like Hagihara, but you actually say Iwara. I got to meet him. And I brought with me my copy of Rondo of Blood, autographed by him, which is like one of my most precious objects of all time.
Don't take that out of its seal.
It's an adorable bag.
I'll take it out of the seal.
But don't do it.
I don't know, because there's something else under it. But I got to meet him, and like they took me to his office, and he was like, way high up at this point. He wasn't working on games anymore.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so.
And I asked him to autograph this, and he was like, he couldn't believe that I knew who he was and that I had this game. And he's like, but if I write on it, it won't be worth any money.
Oh.
Is what he's told me.
You said, I don't care, right?
Yeah, so I'm really proud to have that.
That's cool.
And it's my favorite thing.
What does Panzer Dragoon have to do with anything?
This one, you were asking if the cover on your episode the Data Disc's release of Panzer Dragoon soundtrack, you were asking if the Japanese cover was in fact drawn by Jean-Gerard Mobius, and it is. And I owe this amazing autographed copy to my friend James Milkey, who waited patiently to get this, and as he has many things, he's awesome.
All right. Well, there you go. So a few listener mail, I guess, is what we would call it, from Seth Macy. I have all three of the DS Castlevania games, but I've only played Dawn of Sorrow to completion. Seth, get on that. I've only played two of them.
Well, he played them out of order. Yeah, man. Got
to
go back.
Dawn of Sorrow is the only game other than Donkey Kong 64 I've ever played to 100% completion.
Oh, that's
I have weird tastes.
You like to collect objects.
In the brightest and most optimistic corners of my heart, I hope Nintendo's Switch will help kickstart a new generation of side-scrolling portable Castlevania games, but the realistic corners of my heart, where the blood is, knows it definitely won't happen. Maybe Bloodstained will make its way to Switch.
Doesn't Bomberman R give you a little bit of hope, Jeremy?
No. Especially not at 50 pounds sterling.
Yeah.
So from Adam Odland, the handheld Castlevanias definitely peaked with Aria and Dawn of Sorrow. Circle of Moon was okay. It was nearly unplayable until the GB player. Harmony of Dissonance built from this groundwork and returned to the series canon, but almost felt like they were overcompensating for the faults of Circle. And what was up with Joost?
He has good hair.
The anime art direction of Dawn precipitated the series' downturn. The hauntingly beautiful artwork of Ayami Kojima cannot be replaced. Portrait of Ruin, while all right, definitely had a lot of half-baked gameplay ideas, and the Saturday morning anime aesthetic wasn't doing it any favor. Despite that, Charlotte Olin is one of my favorite protagonists for the series. The gameplay and subtle animations for the character were really fun.
He mostly agrees with us.
And Order of Ecclesia is the only handheld entry I didn't finish. Shout out.
That's most people's.
From Mars Dragon, I'm a big fan of Castlevania who got into the series right around 2001, so the handheld entries all have a special place in my heart. I traded Advance Wars for Circle of the Moon freshman year of high school and considered myself to have come out ahead. I no longer think this, but I still have a weird fondness for Circle. I think all the handheld Metroidvanias have something to recommend them, something that stands out to the point where I wouldn't call any of them bad games per se. Castlevania got me through high school and college, and I still love the series today. Just don't ask about Lords of Shadow. Oh, God, I guess there was
– we're not going to talk about that.
Oh, man. Mirror of Fate. Oh, let's not talk about that.
Those don't belong on this podcast.
Dark Days.
I think that was last scored review I wrote for 1UP.com, and it was a C?
I consider that franchise by its original IP, not the one that it inherited.
Yeah. From Michael Mariano, I missed most of Castlevania's portable run, coming in only for Order of Ecclesia.
Interesting.
I had debated going back and playing previous games, but the sprites seemed smaller. The playthrough looked slower. It didn't seem like there was any compelling reason to go back.
You're wrong.
So, Michael, man, you are in for a treat. You're in for some of the best Castlevania games ever made, some of the best games. They're great stuff. John Learned has fiery Castlevania opinions.
Is it John Lennon?
John Learned. Oh. These are the most important opinions, he says. Circle of the Moon, not as bad as most remember. Dawn of Sorrow, not as good as most remember.
Oh.
Order of Ecclesia has nice art.
Man.
You are banned from listening.
Let's
to Retronauts.
Fire to that guy.
For 3
user,
months.
User
fire
error.
Indeed. Two more.
I'm glad that wasn't John Lennon.
So from Dan Fight. The handheld Castlevania games that
Iga
produced.
Don't we know Dan Fight?
We do.
I know all these people that are writing.
Really?
Jeremy Parrish says, I love Jeremy Parrish.
All the handheld Castlevania games that Iga produced were at the forefront of the modern retro movement and instrumental in bringing me back to video games. In the early 2000s, there was still a strong push for 3D everything. Classic series after classic series was being dragged, kicking and screaming, from their 2D roots into untested 3D waters. In Castlevania's case, this resulted in a series of big-budget polygonal affairs that no one remembers. Meanwhile, in the GBA and DS, Iga was making games brimming with sprite art that could be enjoyed for hours and replayed for extra goodies.
Sure, the handheld Egovanias were derivative of Symphony of the Night, but at a time when the rush to 3D made me think video games weren't for me anymore, the Egovanias had everything I wanted from a game. Maybe this was intentional, maybe it was a happy accident, but those games felt like they were really made for me.
Nicely put, Dan.
P.S. I know Order of Ecclesia is super hard, but Shinoa is great. And if you don't believe me, ask my daughter, Shinoa.
Wow.
Wow. Yep.
All right, one last. Actually, no, my throat is killing me. So everyone who wrote in about Castlevania and whose messages I didn't read.
We're going to do another Castlevania podcast.
We're going to do just an episode of letters. Anyway.
We are running a little bit long. So.
That does wrap it up
for. And I'm going to plug – before I go, I need to plug some stuff. So give me at least 30 seconds.
So right, buy Sony games.
So this wraps it up for the Castlevania Portable episode of Retronauts. Thanks, everyone, for listening. I'm Jeremy Parrish with Bob Mackey, Shane Bettenhausen. We are Retronauts, and you can find us at Retronauts.com on iTunes. And you can support us on Patreon. Please do, because that's how I'm making my living now. This is the first recording session we've done now that Castlevania is a full-time venture for me.
Wait, Castlevania is a full-time venture?
Yes, nice. Castlevania. I mean Retronauts. It's all the same in my
heart.
There's
not a lot of money in that journey.
It's all the same in my heart now. So anyway, you can find us on Twitter, on Facebook, around, about, on Patreon. We're Retronauts, also GameSpite, where I'm doing chronological videos that are part of the Retronauts family now. It's all good. It's awesome. I think we might have ads in this episode because we also are supporting ourselves that way.
Sweet.
So please enjoy those, I hope.
We officially sold out.
Yep. But, you know, I gotta buy baby new shoes. So there you go.
You've got anyway, hungry DS mouths to feed.
I'm on Twitter as GameSpite. Bob, why don't you tell us about
yourself? Sure. Again, that Patreon is patreon.com/retronauts. And you can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. I also write for fandom.com and somethingawful.com. And my other podcast is Talking Simpsons. It's a chronological exploration of The Simpsons. Every Wednesday, a new episode in order. We are currently probably at the beginning of season 5, I'm guessing, by the time this podcast posts. But if you like The Simpsons, you like the podcast, go to TalkingSimpsons.com or search for Talking Simpsons in your podcast device and you'll find it. Thank you, Shane.
Well, and I like that now the free Talking Simpsons are actually good episodes of Simpsons, not like, you know, the first season of Simpsons.
Well, the first season is behind a paywall, so we won't subject you to that.
Exactly.
do you listen, Shane?
I'm a fan.
Oh, wow.
So, tell us about yourself.
So thanks for having me back on. I love the Retronauts. You can find me on Twitter at Shane Watch, all one word. My day job is at PlayStation, where I am an account manager for lots of cool digital publishers. And just to pitch some things that my guys are coming up soon that are relevant to this podcast in the next – well, I don't know when this comes out. But in the spring, you'll be able to purchase on PS4 and Vita East Origin.
Oh,
which
nice.
Is rad and like a thing, something that makes me very happy. Windjammers, as well as Full Throttle Remastered. So those are kind of relevant. And also, Hamster has all these cool classic games always coming out. So check out the Hamster Arcade Archives and the ACA Neo Geo Arcade Archives.
Please put Shadow Hearts on PSN.
Man,
all the games.
Who has it now? You know, Midway stuff all got split up. I wish we could figure
every
it out.
Every game has a different publisher.
I know. Yeah. Because those three would be amazing. I've been trying to figure out who has it.
It's like HTEC, Midway, and XSEED. 1, 2, and 3. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to try to figure it out. Those aren't my guys, but I'll do what I can.
If not, your band.
But yeah.
So anyway, is that everything?
That's everything. And please feel free to invite me back in the future. I love doing this podcast.
Okay, we will invite you back for sure. Thanks for coming on. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We are a weekly podcast now, so join us next week for a full episode because that's what we do. Thanks again. Podcast listening friends, it is I, Jeremy Parrish, co-host of Retronauts, and I'm here to share the good word of Midwestronauts. That's right, both Bob Mackey and I will be taking a break from our lives as coastal elites to return to our Midwestern origins. We'll be going to Midwest Gaming Classic in Milwaukee. Join us on Saturday, April 8th at 3 p.m. for our next live presentation, a look back at Namco's Splatterhouse franchise. We'll be joined by Caitlin Oliver and Kevin Bunch, two experts in the games. And by experts, I mean world-class high-score competitors. It doesn't get more expert than that. So if you're in the neighborhood, come on out to Milwaukee and Midwest Gaming Classic. Experience the magic live. It'll be splatterific.
Life is full of those moments. Like right after that first stretch and yawn in the morning.
Yeah.
Or like standing in the forest alone amid the stillness. The beauty hits you like the crisp air and suddenly everything makes sense and you're one with the earth and stars. Or like dollar drinks at McDonald's.
Keep those awe moments going with $1 any size McCafe brewed coffee and $1 any size soft drinks on the $1, $2, $3 menu. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with combo meal.
The Mueller Report. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute. President Trump was asked at the White House if Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation report should be released next week when he will be out of town.
I guess from what I understand, that will be totally up to the Attorney General.
Maine's Susan Collins says she would vote for a congressional resolution disapproving of President Trump's emergency declaration to build a border wall, becoming the first Republican senator to publicly back it. In New York, the wounded supervisor of a police detective killed by friendly fire was among the mourners attending his funeral. Detective Brian Simonson was killed as officers started shooting at a robbery suspect last week. Commissioner James O'Neill was among the speakers today at Simonson's funeral.
It's a tremendous weight to bear, knowing that your choices will directly affect the lives of others. But cops like Brian don't shy away from it. It's the very foundation of who they are and what they do.
The robbery suspect and a man police say acted as his lookout have been charged with murder. I'm Ed Donahue.